Chapter 53. Statue. That is he your father?
Oh, he is my husband. So this child was married, you see. This was a Saturday. Next day Warner came to dinner and said, oh, go tomorrow, don't fail. He was in love with the girl, and with her husband too, and said he believed there was merit in the statue. Pretty crude work, maybe, but merit in it. Patrick and I hunted up the place. Next day, the girl saw us driving up, and flew down the stairs and received me. Her quarters were the second story of a little wooden house, another family on the ground floor. The husband was at the machine shop. The wife kept no servant. She was there alone. She had a little parlor, with a chair or two and a sofa, and the artist husband's age, and was visible in a couple of plaster busts, one of the wife, and another of a neighbor's child, visible also in a couple of watercolors of flowers and birds, an ambitious unfinished portrait of his wife in oils, some paint decorations on the pine mantel, and an excellent human ear, done in some plastic material at 16. Then we went into the kitchen, and the girl flew around, with enthusiasm, and snatched rag after rag from a tall something in the corner, and presently there stood the clay statue, life-size, a graceful girlish creature, nude to the waist, and holding up a single garment with one hand. The expression attempted being a modified scare. She was interrupted when about to enter the bath. Then this young wife posed herself alongside the image, and so remained, a thing I didn't understand. But presently I did. Then I said, oh, it's you. Yes, she said, I was the model. He has no model but me. I have stood for this many and many an hour, and you can't think how it does tire one. But I don't mind it. He works all day at the shop. And then, nights and Sundays he works on his statue, as long as I can keep up. She got a big chisel, to use as a lever, and between us, we managed to twist the pedestal round and round, so as to afford a view of the statue from all points. Well, sir, it was perfectly charming, this girl's innocence and purity dash exhibiting her naked self, as it were, to a stranger and alone, and never once dreaming that there was the slightest indelicacy about the matter. And so there wasn't, but it will be many a long day before I run across another woman who can do the like, and show no trace of self-consciousness. Well, then we sat down, and I took a smoke, and she told me all about her people in Massachusetts. Her father is a physician, and it is an old and respectable family. I am able to believe anything she says. And she told me how Arl is 26 years old, and how he has had passionate longings all his life toward art, but has always been poor, and obliged to struggle for his daily bread. And how he felt sure that if he could only have one or two lessons in lessons. Hasn't he had any lessons? No. He had never had a lesson. And presently it was dinner time and Arl arrived, a slender young fellow with a marvelous head and a noble eye, and he was as simple and natural and as beautiful in spirit as his wife was. But as he had to do the talking mainly, there was too much thought behind his cavernous eyes for glib speech. I went home enchanted. Told Livy and Clara Spalding all about the paradise down yonder, where those two enthusiasts are happy with a yearly expense of $350. Livy and Clara went there next day, and came away enchanted. A few nights later the Gerhardts kept their promise, and came here for the evening. It was billiard night and I had company, and so was not down. But Livy and Clara became more charmed with these children than ever. Warner and I planned to get somebody to criticize the statue whose judgment would be worth something. So I laid for Champney, and after two failures I captured him, and took him around, and he said his statue is full of faults, but it has merits enough in it to make up for them, whereat the young wife danced around as delighted as a child. When we came away, Champney said, I did not want to say too much there, but the truth is, it seems to me an extraordinary performance for an untrained hand. You ask if there is promise enough there to justify the Hartford folk in going to an expense of training this young man. I should say, yes, decidedly. But still, to make everything safe, you had better get the judgment of a sculptor. Warner was in New York. I wrote him, and he said he would fetch up Ward, which he did. Yesterday they went to the Gerhardt's and spent 2 hours, and Ward came away bewitched with those people and marveling at the winning innocence of the young wife, who dropped naturally into model attitude beside the statue, which is stark naked from head to heel. Now G had removed the drapery, fearing Ward would think he was afraid to try legs and hips, just as S. he has always done before. Livy and I had two long talks with Ward yesterday evening. He spoke strongly. He said, if any stranger had told me that this apprentice did not model that thing from plaster casts, I would not have believed it. He said, tea is full of crudities, but it is full of genius too. It is such a statue as the man of average talent would achieve after 2 years training in the schools. And the boldness of the fellow, in going straight to nature. He is an apprentice, his work shows that, all over. But the stuff is in him, sure. Hartford must send him to Paris 2 years. Then if the promise holds good, keep him there 3 more and warn him to study, study, work, work, and keep his name out of the papers, and neither ask for orders, nor accept them when offered. Well, you see, that's all we wanted. After Ward was gone, Livy came out with the thing that was in her mind. She said, go privately and start the Gerhardt's off to Paris, and say nothing about it to anyone else. So I tramped down this morning in the snowstorm and there was a stirring time. They will sail a week or 10 days from now. As I was starting out at the front door, with Gerhardt beside me, and the young wife dancing and jubilating behind, this latter cried out impulsively, tell Mrs. Clemens I want to hug her, I want to hug you both. I gave them my old French book, and they were going to tackle the language, straight off. Now this letter is a secret, keep it quiet. I don't think Livy would mind my telling you these things, but then she might, you know, for she is a queer girl. Ears ever, Mark. Champney was J. Wells Champney, a portrait painter of distinction. Ward was the sculptor, J.Q. A. Ward. The Gerhardts were presently off to Paris, well provided with means, to make their dreams reality. In due time the letters will report them again. The Uncle Remus Tales of Joel Chandler Harris gave Mark Twain great pleasure. He frequently read them aloud, not only at home but in public. Finally, he wrote Harris, expressing his warm appreciation, and mentioning one of the Negro stories of his own childhood, The Golden Arm, which he urged Harris to look up and add to his collection. Who have pinned a proud feather in Uncle Remus's cap, replied Harris. Do not know what higher honor he could have than to appear before the Hartford public arm in arm with Mark Twain. He disclaimed any originality for the stories, adding, I understand that my relations toward Uncle Remus are similar to those that exist between an almanac maker and the calendar. He had not heard the Golden Arm story and asked for the outlines, also for some publishing advice, out of Mark Twain's long experience. To Joel Chandler Harris, in Atlanta. Elmira, N. YY, August. 10. My dear Mr. Harris, you can argue yourself into the delusion that the principle of life is in the stories themselves, and not in their setting. But you will save labor by stopping with that solitary convert, for he is the only intelligent one you will bag. In reality, the stories are only alligator pears. One merely eats them for the sake of the salad dressing. Uncle Remus is most deftly drawn, and is a lovable and delightful creation. He, and the little boy, and their relations with each other, are high and fine literature, and worthy to live, for their own sakes. And certainly the stories are not to be credited with them. But enough of this. I seem to be proving to the man that made the multiplication table that twice one are two. I have been thinking, yesterday and today, plenty of chance to think, as I am abed with lumbago at our little summering farm among the solitudes of the mountaintops. And I have concluded that I can answer one of your questions with full confidence thus. Make it a subscription book. Mighty few books that come strictly under the head of literature will sell by subscription. But if Uncle Remus won't, the gift of prophecy has departed out of me. When a book will sell by subscription, it will sell two or three times as many copies as it would in the trade. And the profit is bulkier, because the retail price is greater. You didn't ask me for a subscription publisher. If you had, I should have recommended Osgood to you. He inaugurates his subscription department with my new book in the fall. Now the doctor has been here, and tried to interrupt my yarn about the golden arm, but I've got through, anyway. Of course I tell it in the Negro dialect that is necessary, but I have not written it so, for I can't spell it in your matchless way. It is marvelous the way you and Cable spell the Negro and Creole dialects. Two grand features are lost in print. The weird wailing, the rising and falling cadences of the wind, so easily mimicked with one's mouth, and the impressive pauses and eloquent silences, and subdued utterances, toward the end of the yarn which chain the attention of the children hand and foot, and they sit with parted lips and breathless, to be wrenched limb from limb with the sudden and appalling, who got it? Old Uncle Dan, a slave of my uncle's aged 60, used to tell us children yarns every night by the kitchen fire, no other light. And the last yarn demanded, every night, was this one. By this time there was but a ghastly blaze, or two flickering about the back log. We would huddle close about the old man, and begin to shudder with the first familiar words. And under the spell of his impressive delivery we always fell a prey to that climax at the end, when the rigid black shape in the twilight sprang at us with a shout. When you come to glance at the tale you will recollect that it is as common and familiar as the tar baby. Work up the atmosphere with your customary skill, and it will owe in print. Lumbago seems to make a body garrulous, but you'll forgive it. Truly yours, S50. Clemens, the olden arm story was one that Clemens often used in his public readings, and was very effective as he gave it. In his sketch, How to Tell a Story, it appears about as he used to tell it. Harris, receiving the outlines of the old Miss Sourey tale, presently announced that he had dug up its Georgia relative, an interesting variant, as we gather from Mark Twain's reply. To Joel Chandler Harris, in Atlanta. Hartford, 81. My dear Mr. Harris, I was very sure you would run across that story somewhere, and I'm glad you have. A Drummond light, no, I mean a brush light, is thrown upon the Negro estimate of values by his willingness to risk his soul and his mighty peace forever for the sake of a silver 7 pence. And this form of the story seems rather nearer the true field and standard than that achieved by my Florida, Mo. Negroes with their sumptuous arm of solid gold. I judge you haven't received my new book yet, however, you will in a day or two. Meantime you must not take it ill if I drop Osgood a hint about your proposed story of slave life. When you come north I wish you would drop me a line, and then follow it in person, and give me a day or two at our house in Hartford. If you will, I will snatch Osgood down from Boston, and you won't have to go there at all, unless you want to. Please to bear this strictly in mind, and don't forget it. Sincerely yours, S50. Clemens. Charles Warren Stoddard, to whom the next letter is written, was one of the old California literary crowd, a graceful writer of verse and prose, never quite arriving at the success believed by his friends to be his due. He was a gentle, irresponsible soul, well loved by all who knew him, and always, by one or another, provided against want. The reader may remember that during Mark Twain's great lecture engagement in London, winter of 1873-74, Stoddard lived with him, acting as his secretary. At a later period in his life he lived for several years with the great telephone magnate, Theodore N. Vail. At the time of this letter, Stoddard had decided that in the warm light and comfort of the Sandwich Islands he could survive on his literary earnings. To Charles Warren Stoddard, in the Sandwich Islands. Hartford, October 26, 81. My dear Charlie, now what have I ever done to you, that you should not only slide off to heaven before you have earned a right to go, but must add the gratuitous villainy of informing me of it? The house is full of carpenters and decorators, whereas, what we really need here, is an incendiary. If the house would only burn down, we would pack up the cups, and fly to the Isles of the Blessed, and shut ourselves up in the healing solitudes of the crater of Alicala, and get a good rest, for the mails do not intrude there, nor yet the telephone and the telegraph. And after resting, we would come down the mountain a piece and board with a godly, breech-clouted native, and eat poi and dirt, and give thanks to whom all thanks belong, for these privileges, and never housekeep any more. I think my wife would be twice as strong as she is, but for this wearing and wearying slavery of housekeeping. However, she thinks she must submit to it for the sake of the children. Whereas, I have always had a tenderness for parents too, so, for her sake and mine, I sigh for the incendiary. When the evening comes and the gas is lit, and the wear and tear of life ceases, we want to keep house always, but next morning we wish, once more, that we were free and irresponsible boarders. Work? One can't, you know, to any purpose. I don't really get anything done worth speaking of, except during the 3 or 4 months that we are away in the summer. I wish the summer were 7 years long. I keep 3 or 4 books on the stocks all the time, but I seldom add a satisfactory chapter to one of them at home. Yes, and it is all, because my time is taken up with answering the letters of strangers. It can't be done through a shorthand amanuensis. I've tried, that it wouldn't work. I couldn't learn to dictate. What does possess strangers to write so many letters? I never could find that out. However, I suppose I did it myself when I was a stranger. But I will never do it again. Maybe you think I am not happy. The very thing that gravels me is that I am. I don't want to be happy when I can't work. I am resolved that hereafter I won't be. What I have always longed for was the privilege of living forever away up on one of those mountains in the Sandwich Islands overlooking the sea. Yours ever, Mark. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.